to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about. And please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Benetti, and this is Second Sight NYC. We will be broadcasting live on UFO Paranormal Radio on June 18th between 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will be covering the 2011 Paranormal Expo in Auburn, New York, live.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George. Join us as we interview the who's who of the paranormal world, as well as many of the other guests attending the event. This is sure to be a fun-filled 2 hours, so you can all expect the unexpected.
We'll be conducting exclusive interviews with high-profile guests.
And as always, you can expect us to keep it real. Join us in the fun.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome to A Global Focus with guest Joe Montaldo, International Director of ICAR, the International Community for Alien Research, and owner of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Welcome, everyone. Trish Sheridan speaking, host of A Global Focus. Joe Montaldo is tonight's guest. A Global Focus airs live on the International Paranormal Radio Network with its anchor station, UPRN, 105.7 FM New Orleans. Other listening venues include U.S. Stream TV, Live 365, Awcast, Shoutcast, and by mobile phone by dialing 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. Our guest this evening, Joe Montaldo, is co-founder and international director of ICAR, the International Community for Alien Research, with website at www.icar1.com. Originally affiliated with MUFON as an investigator, Mr. Montaldo became disenchanted with the lack of information being shared with the general public. His first step in furthering public awareness was establishing a personal website at www.alienenigma.org, still on the Internet, and this is in 1998. Later, the ICAR site at www.icar1.com was added to the Internet. Born in New Orleans, Louisiana in 1963, Joe Montaldo attended area private schools before joining the United States Navy. While in the U.S. Navy, Joe earned 3 degrees in advanced electronics and avionics. In April of 2004, Mr. Montaldo began hosting the Wake Up USA, a UFO study talk show. He is now host of the new radio program, UFO Undercover. The UFO Undercover website is found at ufoundercover.homestead.com. An investigator for almost 30 years, Joe Montaldo is extremely knowledgeable on UFOs, alien abductions, star children, indigo children, my labs, government involvement, and all matters involved in ufology. In an effort to go directly to the public, a chat room was opened on Pal Talk under Social Issues, the ICAR UFO Alien Phenomena Voice Room. This chat room provides a place for people to exchange ideas, share experiences, and find personal help dealing with alien contact. On the Pal Talk system also is located the virtual auditorium discussion room for the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. The website for the UPRN network can be found at ufoparanormalradio.homestead.com, as mentioned. ICAR started as a grassroots organization and is now established with members in 11 and more countries. While UFO sightings are always investigated, ICAR's main focus is on alien abductions and the alien agenda. ICAR members and Joe have investigated over 5,000 cases of alien contact and abductions. In 2005, Montaldo and members of ICAR provided press coverage in Washington, D.C., at the X Conference, as well as the last two crash retrieval conferences and the 2006 Laughlin Conference. Also in 2006, Mr. Montaldo was placed on the board of the Exopolitics Institute, where he advises in alien abduction and media areas. Mr. Montaldo has been featured in newspaper articles, radio talk shows, and speaks at area meetings, as well as hosting his Wednesday night talk show. Quote, my future goal is to gain information for ICAR and share it with the public. The public needs to understand what is going on with alien contact and exactly what the alien agenda is, end quote. And that's a very prominent quote there of Joe Montaldo. And tonight, several of our ICAR directors are with our audience in the virtual auditorium. As usual, there's several excellent researchers from ICAR and also from ufology and the ETC of subject matter generally. And wonderful guests here, as usual, in our auditorium and regulars. Hi, everyone. Okay, Joe, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for that great introduction. I have to come on Tracy's program. I love the way you do intros. I was listening and going, who the hell is she talking? I always love coming on your show, and I always love the way you do intros. You probably do the best of anybody I've seen anywhere on any network anywhere. You just really, it's a really gift. I got to say it's a gift. But no, thanks for inviting me on because I'd love to come on with you.
Well, you know, Joe, I was thrilled you were going to be my guest this week. And, you know, not only, Joe, do you have many years' experience in abduction matters and in ufology, but you are one of the few in this field with avionics degrees. You served aboard a U.S. aircraft carrier, and you know your aircraft types.
You know, and it's a good thing you bring up because I was just talking with this with a friend of mine over in MUFON the other day. He's a big wigger. I'm not going to mention his name. And we were chit-chatting about this, and I asked him, I was like, why doesn't any of the lead investigators for any of the organizations have degrees in advanced avionics or advanced? And I said, because you really need to understand the way aircraft fly and the way they maneuver and to give you an idea of what's really possible and what's not. Because a lot of people go, oh, it went up and down side to side, that's impossible. Well, no, that's not true. Helicopters go up and down side to side all the time. So do blimps. So it's got to be more than that. I mean, people don't realize, I've seen these hoaxes before, where somebody will take it's just basically a remote control balloon. They'll attach a little motor on it, a little remote control system. They'll blow it up to 4 or 5 feet, and they'll send it on its glowing way, and it'll go up and down and left and right. And what they do to make it disappear, they'll actually just turn it off, and it just goes off, and it looks like it's gone away, but it's still sitting there. Sometimes they'll actually just shoot it and let it come down, and it just looks like it darts off. I've seen this many, many times, and I've heard people describe this as, well, that's an alien cripple. No, it could be something else. So you really got to have an understanding of the way aircraft work, what's possible, what's not. That's like a guy wrote to me the other day. He heard me do a show, and I said something about a black triangle being clocked at Mach 12.5. Well, that's impossible. Well, no. You moron, the shuttle re-enters at between Mach 26 and Mach 38. No, it's not impossible. We already go that fast. We don't have an engine that pushes us that fast, but when we're re-entering, that's how fast we're going. So, yes, we know we can achieve these speeds, and we know they're not going to kill us and they're not going to destroy us. So it's more important for us to really get a grasp on how to identify these correctly. One of the other things I tell people, you know, I was real fortunate by going to private schools. I was in 4-H for 10 years. All 10 years, I was doing photography. So these kind of things you learn really, really, photography and electronics. I've had a fascination with science and electronics since I was like 6. But the photography thing was great. It really gave me an understanding of how photographs work. And then when I went in the service and understand how aircraft works, so now when I'm looking at pictures a lot of times, I can just go, well, no, yeah, no, that's just strictly impossible. And then it also explains for me a lot of the anomalies that people mistake as UFOs, or some type of aircraft. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine about this, too. He's got him a nice new set of Generation 4 night scopes. Pay like 10 G's for these things. And he's telling me about all the stuff he's seeing flying around. I was like, dude, do you really think the skies are that busy? He's like, well, now that you say that, no. I said, well, what do you think is all of that stuff? I mean, you're seeing all this stuff flying around, darting around. What do you think it is? And there's so many explanations because there's so many layers between us and space that you're going to see all kinds of stuff. But most people don't take the time to educate themselves on what they could possibly be seeing before they go see it. So when they're looking at it, they're like, oh, look, UFO wars. Well, no, that is not what's going on, people. There's actually explanations for quite a bit of that. You just got to take the time to go out there and do a little reading, get on the internet. It doesn't even take that much effort these days. But you should always educate yourself as best as you can on any subject matter you're going to get involved with. It's one of the reasons, you know, I went ahead and learned about voice stress analysis and phase. You know, when I was way back when I was younger, one of the companies I worked for actually had us all have to go learn quite a few things, actually, but it involved stuff like facial recognition. It was for hiring and firing is what it's for. To be able to judge a person if they're lying or telling the truth, how plausible is this person while you're interviewing before you go any further with the interview? So it's one of the things they taught us early on. So I had that, and I decided about a decade ago to go ahead and start learning about voice trust. And since then, about 4 or 5 years ago, I actually went ahead and did the 2 online courses for the facial recognition and for the voice stress. Linda already does hypnosis, so we're really in a good position to really understand a lot of what's going on around us. By the way, it doesn't mean we're going to figure anything out, but it makes it better. It makes it easier, and simply it'll be much better researched all the way around when you're dealing with this. It's just a better way of doing business, for lack of a better way of saying it. Really, truly, as far as I can see at this moment, and I know this makes a lot of ufologists mad when I say this, there is no one in ufology doing what ICAR is doing. No one. There's no one even coming close to what we're doing. And even if you combine the top 10 abduction researchers in the field, they're not going to touch on what we just finished. And what we're headed for is out of most of their league, simply because they just don't have the resources or the contactees to get through these types of studies. And instead of this being embraced by the field, watch and see. The blood type study so far has been pretty well embraced, but still, let me stop and go back here so I don't lose the audience. The blood type study is being very well received by abduction researchers and by contactees and abductees. By the overall field of ufology, it is not. They don't even want to hear that there might actually be a real reason why ET is here, other than the government or technologies are saving or killing us. And these are key. This is the stuff that needs to be, most of this we're going to make public. Granted, I will keep some secrets, and I was talking with November about something the other day, so we're going to probably end up keeping a few little secrets, but that's so we have a little bit better criteria when dealing with contactees. I'm going to be doing a pre-record tomorrow experiences. Before we get off, I'll get y'all the information on it, so when he posts it, y'all can find it. And Mike's going to be asking some hard-hitting questions like Treece does, so y'all should pay attention to that. These two shows that I'll be doing tonight and tomorrow night will probably be more informative than the last 3 I've done on abduction research, so you might want to just keep up with them. That's where we are today. It's getting a little strange. Recently, some of the polls and surveys turned up information I wasn't expecting. The blood type study turned up all kind of information I wasn't expecting. Plus, I learned a whole platitude of things that had nothing to do with alien abduction, by the way, dealing with blood types. Like, does anybody know what the oldest living blood type is? Or what blood types do people live longest on? Who has the strongest immunity systems? Well, these questions you would think wouldn't pose anything for abduction researchers, but they do. It's very important questions. Because I think ET would be interesting to people with the strongest immune systems and lived the longest and had the best overall systems. Sorry, I think something in the virtual. I thought I had to go, it's one of these things that when you start looking into them at first, you're going to find all kind of research. But you got to be real careful on the internet. Like today, I was trying to verify what I was just talking about, the oldest blood type study. So I'm reading, right? I'm hitting like 50 sites, each one saying something different. I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. So Joe went over to MDA site. And looked there, and it was posted there prominently, so it made it a lot easier to find. Most of the blood type research you can find online pretty easy. Most of the stuff that people will be hearing me say has been posted on the internet for a very long time. It's just never been tied into abduction research before. No one's ever taken the time to think, well, does ET prefer a blood type? Do they prefer an eye color? Do they prefer a personality? Is there something here that we can look at that will maybe increase or decrease the odds of you being abducted or a contactee? These are paramount for researchers like me because I really want to know this. I want to know what ET is doing here, and I want to know why they're messing with certain people and why they do some type of experiments to some kind, some type to others, and so on and so forth. You know, it's an important thing. I mean, it's also important for me to understand why O blood is so much purer than A and B, and why like 60% of contact each have their blood. It's a thing because only 40% of the world, 46% of the world has O. So it's been weird. It's been weird. But I'm going to shut up for a minute, Teresa, and let you talk.
Well, you know, that's very intriguing. And now, lest I forget, Chipmunk here has a wonderful question for us. He's wondering into these wonderful surveys and that watershed, that beautiful seminal work of November on the mosaic of the extraterrestrial encounter. Of course, she's our Oregon director, a brilliant teacher, lovely human being, very intelligent, like our ICAR staff. We're wonderful people, gifted people. Okay, I'll keep quiet here. Chipmunk, your question is, did you include all the factors that affect lifespans? I think he has included many of these in this key research. Chipmunk, what do you say, Joe? And then I've got some comments.
Well, what I did was, as far as the lifespan thing, is I went to, like I said, the Medical Association site, the MDA site, and I actually went through there and found out why they consider one blood type to be better than the other. Then I went back and cross-checked it across several different colleges and scientists across the Internet, just to get an idea, to make sure, because I mean, we're talking about the Internet, so you got to be a little careful when you're researching on the Internet. But to make a long story short, O blood has the strongest immunity system and the longest lifespan and has less problems overall with disease or anything else for that matter, with the exception of the digestive tract. The O blood itself is quite a bit stronger than the other two blood types. Even though when you read about the three blood types, they say there's no real differences other than, as far as, is there anything dominant over one blood type than another blood type? And in research with initial studies say no, but now that's changing a little bit. They're starting to find out stuff that they didn't really understand before. Like, here's something just dumb. This has nothing to do with abductions or anything, but O blood types are better to have lean meat and poultry and stuff like that, and they're supposed to stay away from dairy and wheat and things like that and grain. Now, that's interesting to know. I mean, it has nothing to do with abduction research, but it shows you the in-depth that they're going into the research. So I'm taking their research, and I'm going against what we're doing, what the contactees are telling us, what the ETs are telling us, what we're understanding that we think is going on amongst them, and correlating it to the blood type of the contactee themselves. Right now, as it stands, let me read this, because I would rather make sure I'm quoting my own self correctly here. You'd think I'd know this by heart, which most of it I do. Right now, you have, where did it go? You have, dang it, doggone it, my computer wants to be crazy tonight. Sorry about that, guys and girls. Where'd it go? Let's see. Where'd it go? Give me a second here. I can make y'all wait.
Joe, in the interim, can I ask you a question from New York Lily? New York Lily, one of our directors, she holds wonderful meetings in the New York area for experiencers, an excellent researcher. Lily's question, Joe, different parts of the world experience different types of ETs. Does that mean that different types of ET prefer different blood types?
Now, you know, that's a damn good question. Y'all let me forget what I was going to say, but that's a damn good question. And the fact that here's something I never thought about until I got into this study. Is it possible, because the Sumerians say that the human-type aliens came here and built these cities and created a start of humanity. Then they said the reptilians came in and interbred with the population. Is it possible that the human aliens were A, the reptilians were B, and of course when they bred together they created AB, and the Greys are O, which by the way, the Greys are much older. The O blood type is older than I thought it was. I thought it was a younger blood type than it was, but it's older than I thought it was. I'll get y'all a timeline on that, Ken. It's something to do with hunter-gathering is how old the O blood is because of the red meat thing. But yeah, different blood types have much different dietary demands too, which in itself is kind of strange. But getting back to what we're talking about, there does seem to be a correlation with blood types and aliens, but there does not seem to be a correlation. Does the Greys, the reptilians, or the human abduct differently through the alien groups? No, it doesn't. Now, that's part of the study we're adding in a couple of weeks. I got some more data coming in, so I'm not going to get into this too much. But I'm trying to find out if the Greys abduct more O positive or more O, A, or B is what I'm trying to find out for all three of the races, meaning – like if the humans really are A, we would think they would want to stick more to their A blood type in abduction. Same thing with the B for the reptilians. And oh, now these blood types could be different. The B might be the humans. The A might be the reptilians. As far as we know, the A could be the Greys and the O could be the reptilians. We're trying to get a handle on this timeline-wise and abduction-wise, knowing what we know about abductions and when we think the first abductions happen. And let me rephrase that. I mean, let me reiterate that. When we think, there is no evidence of any kind to suggest exactly when abduction started. We guesstimate, and I mean guesstimate, between 6,000 and 250,000 years ago. Because no one knows exactly when the Sumerians are talking about these two great dome cities. We don't know. There's just no timeline there. They just talk about it, but they don't say when. We don't know if it was then, 10,000 years earlier, or a million years earlier. We just don't know. So we know this much for sure. Abductions have been going on for at least 6,000 years. And if we want to use the synchronicities of the seven alignments on our planets, the seven constellations that line up only at 12,500 years ago, we can pretty much bet the aliens have been here for at least that long. So we'll figure they've been here for at least 12,000 years, and they've been abducting through family lines for that long. Actually, I think they've created a lot of these family lines that they abducted. Intentionally or unintentionally, I don't know, but I do believe they created some of them. Either through will or just bringing people together on the ships or things along that line. But somehow or another, they created this. And now we've got this mass interbreeding of the A, Bs, and Os that are crisscrossing all over the planet. And then we had to come up with the D antigen because of the O. But y'all didn't know that either. It's just there's a lot of data here to take in, and there's a lot of research still to be done or to be finished, but it does look like there is a correlation between the types of aliens and the types of blood. And if this new study pans out, which I don't know if it is or if it isn't, right now, if I had to tell you right now, I would say as far as I can tell, there is no type of blood that either alien likes more. Other than Rh negative. They prefer Rh negative over Rh positive. But as far as if it's O, B, or A, 40% of contactees are O negative, so you do it. That's across the board. That's not just the Greys or reptilians or humans. That's completely across the board. It's all three types of aliens. So in any way it goes, the reptilians, the humans, and the Greys are almost 66% or 68%, that'll be the updated number, of contactees are Rh negative. And remember, this is more important. Only 15% of the world's population is Rh negative. But yet, almost 70% of contactees are. That's significant. That's extremely significant. And Rh negative has some benefits and factors all over Rh positive. One, we're not related to the monkey. Y'all monkey lovers, that's y'all's problem. Rh positive, the reason I'm picking on y'all is Rh positive is, Rh means Reese's monkey, that's what it stands for. And that's, we share a 2% antigen or something with the Reese's monkey, but Rh negative doesn't. They have no gene in common with the Reese's monkey at all, none whatsoever. And O blood, by nature, is the purest of the three blood types. It has... O negative can be taken by anybody, doesn't matter who it is. You can have any blood type and you can take O negative, but O negative people can only take O negative. That's very significant in itself. And that's something that just didn't even pop up till about 25,000 years ago. That's when the Rh negative factor showed up on our planet out of the blue. No one, even scientists, you can write all day long. I have written at least 40 people on this and they all tell me the same thing. We really don't know where it came from. We don't know why it came or where it came from. So that's interesting in itself. But, and I want to make this clear to everybody, it does not matter what type of blood you have. You can still be abducted, okay? A plus, we have contactees. B plus, we have contactees. B minus, A minus, we have AB plus, AB minus, we have contactees. Just for some reason, in these studies recently, the O's are much higher and the Rh negatives are much higher. So it's ongoing, you guys. It's going to be an ongoing project for some time. But I hope to have the rest of this wrapped up in about 2 weeks because I've been talking with November. We'd like to present, do a joint presentation on a couple of things on COAST. So I'll keep y'all's fingers crossed on that as well because there's some information we want to put on there. Because for y'all who haven't read the NOW project, you should go check it out. The first she sent it to me. I read half of it, then I went back and read the other half of it. Then there was some stuff in there I thought that, no, she didn't write that. That's not right. And I went back and read it again. Oh, yes, it is. So I found that interesting. And since this has been done, I asked her, and we haven't discussed it any further than this, but we're going to do, like, part two of this is strictly only for abductees and contactees. The personality, this test was open to everybody, the one she just finished.
Yes, now project. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was open to everybody. The second one is going to be a closed project, open only to abductees and contactees. And we're going to see where that, what rabbit hole that takes us down. It's just we're learning so much that we didn't expect to find. I really, Teresa, I got to be honest with you. I did not expect to find any correlation with blood types against aliens. I really didn't. I didn't think it was going to be anything as significant. I thought we were going to find the same percentages of blood types as we found inside of the inside the regular population is what I thought. But, you know, one of them things I'm learning as I'm going.
Well, you know, we're having an interesting discussion here in the chat room. Gemlight, you answered Gemlight's question. She had a very intriguing observation, wondering if a certain blood type would prevent one, would be an exclusionary factor to prevent an abduction. And you're saying, no, that's not the case. Also, Joe, several of ICAR's abduction criteria have been incorporated by many ufologists and ufology groups. Often this assumption of ICAR concepts and terms have been made without proper attribution to ICAR. Here I'm thinking of such concepts as the screen memory and the download. Now let's hope that this current research is not going to be incorporated by others or adapted by others or adopted rather by others without proper attribution to ICAR. And Joe, ICAR, just as you noted here, continues to make tremendous strides in setting firsts in abduction research. For example, ICAR's Oregon director, November Hansen, has produced a very informative and engaging work. It's recently published. It's available at the ICAR site for free download so everyone can access it. The name of the book is The Mosaic of the Extraterrestrial Encounter. It includes, among its contents, the analysis of the Gray Alien Questionnaire. What a wonderful work.
Oh, it is. November by herself is going to change part of ufology all by her little lonesome. I don't want to be undue modest about it because, I mean, there's a lot of people contributing and helping to what she's doing. But these are projects she decided to take on, okay? This is stuff that she wanted to do to help the organization, like other directors do. She just decided to take these on. These are bold, sweeping projects that have long-term consequences for the field as we produce more of this information over the next 2 years. I mean, it's basically, ICAR is going to change you. It already has. And I've been written recently, like, I'm going to start posting these, but I get letters all the time about how much more acceptable abductions are inside the ufology field today, how it's so much nicer that it's actually being taken serious inside the field and even by some press. And we do get a lot of credit for that, but we're not the only ones doing it. But, yes, we do push a much harder, longer agenda. And, yes, Joe does have a big mouth. You know, you're not going to – I'm not easily intimidated, okay? You're not going to – you know, the big boys in ufology aren't going to say, well, Joe, you better sit down or you're not going to get to speak anywhere. You know what Joe says? Well, Joe's just going to start his own radio network and y'all can take a fly and you know what. And that's just the way things have got to be sometimes. And then we have become a force to reckon with now. If you want to do real research or you want to get your research out, we're one of the bigger people that can do it for you these days. And so ufology has had to come somewhat reluctantly to us, but you're right in the fact that we don't get near the credit. We have directors that do things that we don't even hear. Nobody ever even hears about. You hear other people take credit for it. It's like when I redid the Betty and Barney Hill case. I'm listening to Coast to Coast. Six months later, I'm listening to Coast to Coast. Somebody's on there saying how this is their theory. I'm thinking, excuse me? But George corrected him, by the way. George said, oh, no, that Joe Montaldo came up with that. And then a couple months after that, our Wisconsin state director writes to me about somebody else trying to take credit for it. And the blood type study now, I have seen at least a half dozen people try to take credit for it. And I'm thinking, look, people, the terminologies like, you know, downloads and things like that, that is directly ICAR and the paranormal radio, I mean, ICAR and the UFO alien phenomena group. Those people, not just me, but those people turned all these things. And the reason they got out into the public was, is I was hosting Wake Up USA at the time. And what would happen is we'd have group meetings, you know, in case most people didn't know, but when I used to do Wake Up USA, we used to have group meetings on Tuesday before the show and then Wednesday after the show. So I'd already be prepped and warmed up for the guests. I was already using iCar terminology when we hit them. So after a while, everybody started hearing it and they started using it themselves. We just never got credit for it, which bites. Things like that are irritating. I mean, because we work really, really hard to spend a lot of our own money on this. You personally know, I know you spent quite a lot over the years on it. I can tell you all this much. If me and Treese could recoup what we spent in the last 5 years, yeah, we could retire. And take it easy for a little while. And that's the truth of the matter, guys. I hate to say that, but it's the truth of the matter.
You know, iCar and its members devote a great deal of time, effort, and also, indeed, some of their own budgets to try to further the research, important research now. And, for example, with this blood project, more than 1,400 contactees participated in that study, and the conclusions resulted from analysis of findings from 20 different sources. And, you know, on the iCar concept of the download, you know, I had done an essay on the Internet at my site. It's down now, but the name of the my first one is down now. My current site is very much up. But the essay was entitled In Defense of Humanity. But the point I'm trying to make is I went to iCar for iCar's definition of download. Now, this is iCar's definition. It's an excellent one. Now, this is iCar's definition of download, a concept that they discovered. Quote, let's see. A phenomenon first discovered by iCar research, here's the quote, the download can entail a streaming of images, symbols, or other data in an alien data transmission format to the experiencer with the data's full or even partial significance, often not understood at the time, end quote. That's just one of the many abduction criteria concepts and related findings from iCar. Now, let's see. Joe, November at this time also has produced a survey on the reptilian abduction, the reptilian questionnaire, and you were referencing her NOW project, that personality type research project as to the personality types and traits of experiencers. Both the NOW project questionnaire and the report analyzing the research findings have been posted at the iCar website. What's the feedback you're getting from that, Joe?
So far, it's been excellent. I haven't had any bad feedback at all, which kind of scares me a little bit. Really, we've had excellent. Everybody's been really happy with it. You know, I got to cheat a little bit because I was reading these as they were coming in, as they were being sent in November. Everything that we work on the iCar site, I get a copy of to my own personal email so that if I want to look at it, I can. Most of the time, I don't because I just prefer the directors to do it on their own and then send me the results. And but anyway, to make a long story short, I was perusing Judy's, and one afternoon I was sitting talking with Linda, and we just pulled them all, and we went through them, and it was so interesting because I mean, you're looking at these, and you're seeing this group, that group, this group, that group, this group. Now some of these people I know personally, you know, because I'm friends with them, and I'm mm-hmm. seeing, wow, they do fit in that group. Wow, they do fit in that group. Wow, they do fit in that group. And by the way, I didn't fit in mine, but we're going to leave that alone. But still, it was an excellent survey. And when it was all said and done and I was reading through it and reading some of the conclusions November had came to, which I thought were excellent, by the way, I was thinking, you know, this is going to be so much better when we curtail this strictly to the abductee and contactee. Even though in this poll, I mean, in this project, there are quite a few contactees that took it. Probably half of them were contactees or abductees. So we can get a sense, but since it's not a formal study on abduction contactees, we're not going to coin it as that. And it's really November's baby, so I leave it mostly for her to talk about. I can't wait to hear her on Coast or somewhere like that discussing it because it's going to be a great interview, and it really is going to be it's an important piece of work. The reptilian thing should be out in a few weeks. I talked to her. She popped me off a Facebook question the other day, to let me know that it was in its works. And sometime in the next week or two, I might get everybody to write in the Coast, you never know, because pretty soon we're going to be wanting to go on to release a lot more of this data. I'm just getting some other interviews out of the way before then. But the data is really clean, guys. Most of it's pretty explanatory. You can really see the chain of events happening here. You can really see how things unfold. In other words, O negative and green eyes are both mutations, out of the blue mutations. Happened around 20, 25,000 years ago. Was one correlated to the other? I have no idea. Scientists say, oh, green eyes are from blue and brown, but they also know that, first off, green eyes were very, very, very rare. Even today, they're fairly rare. Only like 8% of the population have them. But when you go back 10,000 years, they were almost non-existent. As far as they know, there was none. They were looking for the earliest mention, which I think is around 2,600 years ago. So it was a very rare thing. In a lot of the world today, it's still a very rare thing. Green eyes, you only find in mass in certain countries. You're not even going to find them anywhere else, which happen to be countries with a large concentration of contact teeth. Coincidence, probably. But still, it is there. I mean, it is there. Blue eyes and brown eyes make up roughly about 88. Well, if you do it by the book, they make up like 90-something percent of the eye colors. But, you know, everybody likes to say, I got this color blue or that color brown, or I got hazel or gold or whatever. There's only two eye colors, brown and blue. There's all kind of shades of them, but there's only two eye colors, brown and blue. Green is a mutation of brown and blue, according to what scientists say. But it is just odd that they haven't mutated very many times. It's just a little odd. It's a very rare mutation, so you got to kind of wonder about this. It's not as rare as it used to be, but it is a rare mutation. But O negative or Rh negative is also a mutation. And they do think they happened around the same time. So something in that new bloodline kicked this off. Something that was going on. There seems to be, when you look at the Rh negative,
intriguing.
There seems to be a direct correlation to this. It's just weird when you look at this. Sorry, that was somebody beeping my phone. Like, who the hell's calling me? everybody knows I'm going to interview tonight. It's kind of weird. But go ahead, I'll shut up for a minute.
Very intriguing information, Joe. Thank you. Joe, you describe from time to time the fact that there is a core group of contactees at ICAR. What types of interaction are represented by this core group of contactees, for example, groups, dream concepts, or impressions, which can be shared by members of this particular core group?
Sorry, I had some questions coming from the peanut gallery at the same time. Wait, just say that last part again. I just missed the last part.
On that core group of contactees that are discussed from time to time at ICAR, for example, groups, dream concepts, impressions can be shared among them.
Yes.
Your comments on that?
Well, you know, we found out about the core group thing by accident. This goes way back to the Yahoo days. This had nothing to do with MUFON research or ICAR research or anything else. We started noticing, because of other groups, that contactees tend to group up together. And at first we were thinking maybe it was convenience, or there was, you know, back in the day there was so few places where contactees could meet and group and not be ridiculed, not be hated. But at first that's what we thought it was. But then we realized, no, they're drawn to each other. You know, this group of contactees, and it's not an age thing. This is something, guys, ICAR does admit when it makes mistakes, and it does correct them. Initially, we thought this was an age thing, like, okay, lot A1B, you know, age 35 to 55. Made sense. Or, oh, no, it's not an age thing. It's a bloodline thing. It's related to family bloodlines. This core group has probably got this 100 or 1,000 bloodlines in it. That core group's probably got that 100 or 1,000 bloodlines in it. They're all drawn and pulled together. It's like a giant damn family is what it is. It's really, really weird. It's not a family enough that you're interbreeding or things along that lines, but it is a family in the sense that these people feel connected together. They feel close to each other. And what the groups have learned, not only amongst themselves but amongst the other groups, is they can dream weave. They can communicate on levels that we didn't realize before. Dream weaving is an easy thing that most everybody can do with a little bit of concentration. If you've got someone you're relatively close to, you can test this out. Just start trying to send your dream to your spouse or to a friend, somebody you trust. You know, that's not going to make an idiot out of you but generally with a little practice, I can't say this for everyday people, but for contactees, generally with a little practice, they can send and receive this pretty easy. Once you learn how to do that, a lot of times you can send other things. Now, put this in perspective, and this gets me in trouble, gets Linda in trouble sometimes too. We'll be driving along, and I'll say something kind of smart, but And I'll hear the response from Linda before she says it. And a lot of times I'll respond to her before she says it, and then she's looking at me like, well, you blank, blank, I didn't say that. Well, no, you did, but you thought it. But she does me the same thing. And then a lot of times it gets weird because we'll be talking about stuff, and we'll both have the same thought, but then we don't know whose thought was it. Was it my thought or was it her thought? That gets really weird, by the way. It's this goes well way beyond that. I got lots of married friends, and yes, granted, I've been married 30 years, it's a much different thing, but no, this goes way beyond that. It's not about stuff that you would consider like everyday mundane thing. We've been driving, and we were down in Alabama just recently, talking about some other things, research related. And I'd go say something, and she'd just, and our research isn't always that close. There are certain things Linda and I do not agree on when it comes to the grades. It's just part of doing research. It's not anything we fight or get mad about. It is things we don't agree about. This is something that's just beyond that. And it's not just with her. This happens with a lot of the core group members and even just casual friends. But I realized early on that it doesn't happen with everybody. I learned that I can send images and thoughts a lot of times to just about anybody, but I've learned that pretty much only contactees really respond. That's why sometimes when I'm like scanning a room or going somewhere, or even on a job interview, a decade ago, I got on a job interview and I'm thinking to this guy, man, you need to hire me, just blah, 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 blah. And I got this thing back, yeah, I really like you, you're right, I think you're going to be all right and do good with us. I realized right then and there he was a contactee. And then later on, after working for him a little while and talking with him, yes, he was definitely a contactee. It's one of the other reasons ICAR incorporates contactees into their researches. Not every researcher for this organization is a contactee, and it is not a prerequisite to be a researcher. But you can bet your butt half of our staff are contactees. And it's never going to change because, frankly, I want their input. I want to know what they think about individuals when they come in. Like Tracy's doing an investigation on somebody, and she sends in a conclusion, and then she passes it to two or three of the contactees in the group, and they do it. It's interesting to see how everybody's going to judge this. Now, for the non-contactees in the group, they may see it one way as a contactee, they may see it other, but every now and then, both groups use it the same way, and I know I got something then. I know I got it. It's really good when they get together like that. I'm like, oh, yeah, we got something good here. We can lock this down as information. But abduction criteria, all of these things are just so important now to what we do. And frankly, I'm still on this thing about we don't get enough credit, by the way.
I totally agree with you. And now one of our researchers here who I believe wants to be anonymous, he always asks excellent questions, wonders if among this core group there are individuals who are contactees with the light beings.
Well, okay. I know a lot of people don't like this, but when it comes right down to the light beings, yeah, any contactee can have a light being experience. Will every contactee? No. Will most? No, they won't. But yes, you can just be an individual contactee in any core group and be contacted by them. You have to send me a better description, but light beams can appear as anything anyway, so a lot of times I think they're kind of hokey sometimes, though. I don't know if it's the contactee or the light beam, but something that gets a little hokey sometimes in the way they manifest themselves, we'll say. And I can tell you this, the light beams are probably directly responsible for a full third or more of what people have seen as ghosts or these sparkly things. Or I guarantee they were seeing these things. Whether it was by accident or not, I have no idea, or by design, but it does happen. But I would say on average, it's going to be hard to put a number on, maybe 5% of abductees, contactees, see the light beams, and everyone who's ever seen them says it's a profound experience. They don't want to call it angelic because it's spiritual in the sense that it uplifts you in a way you've probably been never uplifted before. But it's not spiritual in the sense that you're looking at God or an angel. You're looking at extraterrestrial. It's just a very advanced, very beyond anything we understand extraterrestrial, somewhere that humanity may be in a billion years or 2 billion years. That's something else I got to thinking about when going back on the blood type thing. If each alien did contribute a blood type, meaning, one was A, one was B, one was O, sometime in our future, it's only logical that we will surpass all three of our creators. And it may be one of the reasons they do stick so close to us and do keep such a good eye on us. Because, you know, from what I understand about the Greys, they can really see pretty far ahead and pretty far back. So they may know what's coming. They may know the human race may be the new light beings in 2 billion years. And people are like, 2 billion years? Well, let me tell you what, guys. The galaxy's already 15 billion years old. It's going to live for several trillion. So 2 billion is nothing but a drop in the sand for a race that could potentially live for hundreds of billions of years. That's nothing. 2 billion is nothing. I know people are like, well, I want to be a light beam tomorrow. It ain't going to happen, guys. I'll be the first one to tell you, mankind's not even ready for any form of ascension. All these people who like to me, we're ascending. Yeah, we're descending. We're not ascending. Lord, look around, people. All right, I'll be good.
No, those are very prescient observations there, Joe. You know, Joe, you find a great significance to patterns in ufology and ET scenarios. Each experiencer and his or her account are different, yet the key patterns found by ICAR are now acknowledged by the majority of the key ufologists, and actually ICAR's findings as to patterns are recognized by these major ufologists.
But we're getting better. I mean, more and more people are paying attention. And people like yourself and Stephen Bissett and others have really helped in these areas. Stephen's been an advocate of ours for years. You know, he's pushed us when he didn't have to. He's invited us to conferences and let us speak when he didn't have to. You know, he's put us in positions like the Costa. I owe him just for the interview he got me in D.C. when I was there. Getting me an in-studio interview with George Noria at NBC Studios in D.C. was priceless. And it's not something he had to do. But he did. And I felt good because I got the good, and the other two interviewees were Alfred Weber and Richard Dolan. I mean, I was in excellent company. So, you know, for me it was a great experience. It's the shortest interview I've ever done on Coast to Coast, but it was a great experience. So I owe him just for that alone, but his exposure for us in the field, he's been a great proponent of it. And yes, I have dogged him, and yes, I've been on his ass about, you know, Steven, disclosure's got to come from the contactee, the contactee, the contactee. He's an advocate for contactees now. He's a big friend with Kim Carlsberg. He gets involved in it now. He's looking at the Hellkid conference is going for contactees. So it shows you what the right friends and the right amount of pressure can do for anybody. He helped us, we helped him, he's helping us, we're helping him, and it's a good thing. And he's been a good advocate for it. And there's been several others in the field that have helped. And of course, then we've got our ones that would rather see us die than help, but still. And then we've got our associate friends like Darrell Sims. Darrell Sims is a friend of an organization. He's not a member of ICAR. We do not do joint research, but we do swap research. We will discuss different forms of different things that are going on at the same time. We also do that with Yovan Smith and Mary Radwell. These are researchers that I keep in regular contact with, whether it's through interviews or writing, just so I know what's going on. Matter of fact, when all this abduction stuff is finished on UFO and the cover and the panels are done, I will probably do a panel with the four top researchers in the field just to discuss where we're all at and what pages we're on. Because, you know, when I talk with Mary Radwell, her and I are about 75% in sync in what we think's going on and how we think it's going on. Darrell Sims is the same way. Don't get me wrong, there are definitely differences that we all think or believe. But 75% of our research is in sync. Same thing with Yovan Smith. Even with Bud Hopkins, David Jacobs not so much, he's out somewhere, but us all kind of are on the same playing field, which is really, really nice. It's like when my good friend Alfred Weber got us on the how many contactees they are. You know, abduction researchers have been saying this for 2 decades, 10 to 15%, 10 to 15%, 10 to 15%. Well, when you hear 10 to 15% of the population, you think, oh, that ain't many, 10%. You know, what's 10%? 10% is 700 million people. 15% is 1.2 billion people. So Alfred did the math on the radio one night, and of course I'm still getting emails over this 2 years later. But bottom line is, it doesn't matter what researcher you ask, they're still going to tell you 10 to 15% of the population. They might not want to hear the billion word, but they're still going to tell you 10 to 15% of the population. And those are numbers that are come by a couple of ways. For us, for ICAR, we do it like this. Let's say that Joan and Gene Smith got married 10,000 years ago, and they had 10 kids. And each one of those had 5 kids, and each one of those had 3 kids, and so on and so forth till modern times. That one family would have contributed, I think it's like 3 or 4 million people in the overall scheme of things, just by doing it that way. Well, when you stop and think, there may have been anywhere from 1,000 to 1 million initial contactees. That puts the population today at a much larger population than any of us want to think about. So a lot of researchers are now content to stay at the 10 to 15%. Bottom line is, we don't know, ladies and gentlemen. We're speculating. We don't know. We do it that way. Darlin do it a different way. They're doing it by what percentages of actually being turned in versus what percentage has never been reported versus what percentage are abductees. Meaning that for ICAR, about 50% of our reports are reported by contactees. 50% of our reports are reported by abductees. And then we have our MILABs and REABs and stuff like that. But basically, you know, that's the numbers and how they come in. And then just a matter of using them for what we want to use them for, the different ways we use it all. But it does help. I mean, it is helping us understand when it got started, how it got started, maybe why it got started, maybe where it's going. There's a lot of maybes there, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sorry for that, but you know what? Until I can get E.T. to come sit down and have coffee and or tea and crumpets, we're going to be speculating a lot. I mean, to make a long story short, we use a lot of methods at ICAR to gather information, including programming of contactees. Which, by the way, I got a letter the other day that told me that was very unethical and I should be ashamed of myself. I was like, why? It's not like I'm putting a gun to the contactee's head and saying, learn this. These are volunteers. And they're fully and functionally aware of what may or may not happen when they do these things. And even then, the information is still got to be taken with a grain of salt. But that's why you do, like, okay, let's say we want to know about the blue plasma. So we're going to gather, we're going to start off with 5 contactees. And we're going to say, just ask the grays, what's the blue plasma? Ask the grays, what's the blue plasma? Ask the grays, what's the blue plasma? And they'll program this up for a couple of weeks. And then, bam, they'll ask. And then they'll come back and tell us. Now, if all 5 of them basically give us the same answer, we'll do it with 10 or 15 other people. And if they come back and give us the same answer, then we know we got something. You know, we know we got it. And we can include it into what we're doing. Because we don't make any of this public until after the fact. Nobody gets to know what everybody else knows until we're done. Dale, I'm still wondering why it was unethical. Okay, I don't know what we were doing that was considered unethical, but apparently it was unethical. I don't personally think so. I think getting contactees to program and ask questions is the fastest way to get information, and it does help us to rule out things. Because since we're doing multiple contactees in multiple groups across multiple core groups, when we're having these questions asked, we're having them asked by different grays in different areas or different reptilians in different areas in different sections, and we're getting an across-the-board answer. So we know it's probably more truth than lie. Notice I said probably, because we do know ET lies. And we don't know how much they think ahead. And they're not volunteering the information, and they really need to be volunteering information. So this is a way to do it. But I know we got about a minute for break, Tree, so I'm going to shut up and let you take us out.
Absolutely. And everyone, we'll be back in about 10 minutes' time with our guest, Joe Montaldo, the International Director of ICAR, the International Community for Alien Research, and owner of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. During our break, feel free to look at the www.icar1.com website. Also, the UFO Undercover website can be found at ufoundercover.homestead.com. And also check out that UFO Undercover program of Joe's that's aired every Wednesday live. Right now, Joe is doing a fascinating series of contactee interviews. Don't miss them. They're very well worth the listening. And, of course, his website is UFO, oh, heavens, ufoundercover.homestead.com. Back in 10 minutes, everyone. Bye-bye.
Expect the unexpected.
We'll be conducting exclusive interviews with high-profile guests.
And as always, you can expect us to keep it real.
Join us
in the fun.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Welcome back to A Global Focus and the second hour of our interview with guest Joe Montaldo, the International Director of ICAR, the International Community for Alien Research, and owner of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Welcome back, everyone, to our interview with Joe Montaldo. Now, Joe, you often reference the enhanced abilities of experiencers. Could you mention here the full spectrum of experiencers across the population? For example, the age, profession, cultural groups that encompass the experiencer group, I guess it's across the board. Also, do you think, Joe, that ET is interested primarily in the contactees, and why not in humanity as a whole?
Well, all of that is good stuff. As far as we can tell, there is no group of any kind, no race of any kind, no sex of any kind that isn't abducted. It doesn't seem to matter what you are. To the person that said that the president has been abducted, I don't know, but it's quite possible that they have been. You couldn't rule that out. And I do know some presidents that were O negative, which increases their chances of being abducted. So it's one of those things you got to stop and wonder, but it is quite possible, yeah, even some presidents have been abducted. But as far as policemen, firemen, doctors, lawyers, politicians, you'd be surprised how many of them that talk to us. You really, really do. I just seen that again pop up. We run the conference in Auburn, New York, June 18th. It's an expo up there. Second Sight will be there. Second Sight NYC will be there broadcasting live from the conference. From here, it's going to be pretty good. The lineup is excellent. You can find information on Second Sight. You can go to Paranormal Radio Network and just click on Second Sight. I don't think so. It's only 2 weeks away, and it doesn't look like we're going to get the time off because we went from being dead to busy, which I'm really happy about. So I'm taking advantage of any money that's coming in right now. Unless some changes, you know, if something falls out the sky or something, then I might. But other than that, I'm going to be careful. But I know Stephanie and Chris are going to be there. I expect them to do an excellent job. They're doing an excellent job now. We'll be broadcasting, I believe, 2 hours live from the expo. So if y'all are there, drop in, say hi, you know, come by and say hi to the Paranormal Radio Network. There's something else, but anyway, they'll be on their show next Thursday. They'll be discussing the expo in depth and what's going to be going on and who's going to be there. From what I heard about it 2 weeks ago, it sounds like it's going to be really fun and really good. So if y'all can get up there, you might want to check it out and go enjoy yourselves. Auburn, I hear, is awful beautiful this time of year anyway, so can't be like it is down here. We've been breaking records in the hundreds, man. We're not even barely into June. I'm like, come on, people. It's hot. Oh, yeah, maybe it's all the oil still in the Gulf. just kidding. Mm. But it is. It's really hot down here right now. It's getting bad. So if you can, go up and check out the conferences. But getting back to what Therese originally asked me, it doesn't really, as far as I can say, there really is no groups that don't get picked up. Now, is there favorites? You know, that's interesting. Somebody wrote to me a few minutes ago and said, aren't housewives their favorite abductee? You know, that's interesting where you said that our housewives their favorites. I mean, there are a lot of housewives abducted. Is it because more housewives are RH negative? I guess that's something we could look into, but I don't think so. I mean, I just think that's just some of the people who came forward. Maybe because housewives have some time alone during the days, that it might have been easier for them to overcome some of this and come out easier, because if they freaked out and wasn't screaming that stuff, nobody was there to see them but them. So it may, and then this is sheer speculation, so no one writes to me about this because I really don't know, but maybe it allowed them to visualize or deal with this easier. And then again, maybe not. Or maybe they had better spousal support, their husbands understood. I don't know, but there are a lot of them that have come out. I wouldn't be able to say it was more like 10 or 15% of the overall group, but still, there are a lot of them. But there's a lot of everything. You know what surprises me is there's a lot of damn lawyers. You and he's going to have a talk about this. All right. Now, not to hate on lawyers, because I got several good friends that are lawyers, okay? That, by the way, they're the only lawyers I like. I got to be honest with y'all about that. They're friends of mine, so I like them. The rest of them, I'm not so thrilled with. But in all fairness, because I don't just hate on lawyers here, you know, a good chunk of them are cops. And, you know, when you grow up with cops like we've got in New Orleans, you got to wonder what he's interested in these guys. You just got to wonder. But just to make a point, I mean, E.T. doesn't seem to care. You know, as in what your career is or what your skin color is or what your, you know, what your hair color is. What they do seem to care about are you related in family lines? Is there abduction in your family lines? Your types of blood. But that, the type of blood thing may go all the way back to the original abductions, because think about this. If you look at any blood type study done recently, not anything that ICAR has done, just regular scientific blood type studies, you'll notice that South America is 99.999% O. You will also note that Central America is 99.999% O. Now, here's something for y'all, and I asked this directly to two DNA specialists and three doctors. I said, now, explain this to me. The majority, the overall majority of blood in Africa is A and B. So, let me get this straight. If we migrated out of Africa, came across the land bridge, came down into the things, shouldn't the prominent blood types here be AB? Especially near the land bridge, meaning Alaska and Canada and the West Coast, which, by the way, isn't what it is. America is about 54% O blood type. And O is kind of concentrated high in areas where the land bridge was and down the coast and down in South America and in little spots in the rest of the country. So I asked him this. I'm like, well, I don't understand. I said, why would there be so much O here who started here? Then the guy writes back to me, the Antonio that I'm working with, one of the doctors I'm working with, three on this blood type study, by the way, all PhDs. And he writes back to me and goes, you know, John, I never thought of it like that. He said, but you got a valid point. He said, O is prominent in these two areas more than any blood types on the planet. He said, so it would make sense that that's where the blood type started and then migrated up. Well, if you follow the map, you will notice that the blood type goes up the West Coast and then jumps into the middle of the country. But it goes all the way up the West Coast and then crosses over into Russia. And right where the two land bridges are, there's actually a high concentration of O, not AB, which is what it should be. So now these guys are having to look at a whole new ball of wax. What we might have got was A and B coming out of Africa and O coming out of South America and all merging in Europe. And then those people in Europe coming back to the United States later on, and that's exactly what the map looks like. So now this guy, here I am, I'm a nobody UFO researcher, and I got these guys scratching their head going, what the hell? Now, how can someone, a layman like myself, even see things like this that these PhDs have been working on their whole life? Maybe it's because I'm a contactee. Whatever it is, they're now looking at it. They did take it very seriously. And they're really, truly looking at this. I get emails from these guys on a regular basis now. They keep me up to speed on what kind of research they're going on, who they've talked to about the different ideas. They're not mentioning aliens to anybody. But they're mentioning the fact that, yes, the O is prominent from there, and it does look like it moves up, not down, and over. So, you know, all it really proves is something I've always said. Maybe instead of just two people out of Africa, life simultaneously sprung up on this planet in two or three locations. If that was true, then it would explain the A, it would explain the B, and it would explain the O, and it would explain the mixings of the bloods in the different areas and why some areas are higher and some areas are low. That would actually explain that, or if you had alien intervention. Nothing else, though, is going to explain it, and I've asked this question again, because since I'm working with all these doctors, I asked them, what does it take to have a viable, healthy population of 7 billion, which is where we're at? You have to have a starting population of a minimum of 3,600 individuals, meaning that two people could not pop up and start life on this planet. What would have happened is you would have had massive inbreeding. In the beginning, it would have been so bad that probably hardly none of them would have survived. And the few that would have been either very smart or retarded, one or the other. And even in today's society, you can see what heavy inbreeding does to a family. It'll either give you, it has a tendency to take either the really bad or the really good. There doesn't seem to be any middle ground there. And these are really important things when you're doing this kind of research. It really helps you to understand that, oh, wait, it's not what we originally thought it was. Just like a body clock being set to 24 and a quarter hour days. What is that? We live on a planet with a 23 and three quarter hour day. Why is our body clock a half an hour longer than the planet we live on? You gotta scratch your head when you see stuff like that. why is the optimal body temperature for a human 63 degrees Fahrenheit and we live on a planet that's optimal 73 degrees Fahrenheit? Doesn't sound like we evolved here, people. Either there was some kind of intervention or we were brought from somewhere else, but it really does not see how it is. Who knows?
It's one of those things. Very intriguing concepts there, Joe, that research area ever expands. Joe, on the subject of disclosure, do I understand this correctly? You believe that E.T. has already made disclosure to those humans whom E.T. wishes to be aware of their existence. What are your full thoughts on this?
Oh, yes, 100%. I believe E.T.'s told everybody that E.T. wants to tell us. I don't think E.T. could care about the rest of the population in any shape, form, or fashion. You have to judge E.T. like you would judge your neighbors, anybody else, by their actions and what they do. And what they do is take people against their will, whether it's a good experience or a bad experience, they still take them against their will. Generally, they're either in giving them knowledge or doing experiments to them or things, but none of this is the will of the individual. This is all stuff. Now, later on, you may want to work with them, you may want to help them, you may want to do a lot of things with E.T., but still, they're still taking you. There's a fundamental lack of respect for our species by these aliens. They really think they're better than us. And in science, technology, and in brain power, they are better than us. As far as souls and spirits go, I have no idea if they're better or if we're better. Who knows that? That's all speculation there. But still, you know, we know some things that they're just better than us in some things. But like I said earlier in the show, it is possible that we will one day be the dominant race simply by evolution. If these three races have interbred with us, and now we're breeding only their good qualities back into our population, then yes, one day we will be the dominant species. Or it could be something a little bit more sinister and a little bit more simple. Maybe this segment of the population, the contactee segment of the population, has been altered in the fact that we do know they are empathic and telepathic. We also know that most contactees are natural-born survivors, which is an interesting thing in itself. We know several things. We know, like the Rh factors and the O factors, we know those people have high immune systems that could survive things. We also know that maybe the contactees have been genetically altered to withstand particular viruses. If you wanted to reclaim the planet with the bare minimum of fuss and mess, the easiest way to do it would be to create a pandemic that would kill everybody but the people you wanted not to kill. So if you were breeding these contactees 10,000 years ago or a million years ago, whatever it was, 5 years ago, they could have introduced something into the genes that makes these people immune to any virus and then simply just release a virus and take out what they considered to be the wasted part of our population for whatever reason it is that they would do this. But they could do it quite easily, and it would be the easiest way to do it. You know, people ask me all the time, are they here to save us, are they here to kill us? Well, at this point, ladies and gentlemen, at this point, they've been around a long time. They haven't wiped us out. So that's a good sign. At least, as far as we can tell, they haven't even attempted to wipe us out. But we also know they have not enlightened us. You know, for all the contactees that tell me, oh, we're being enlightened, well, that's a load, okay? Look around the planet. It's all you got to do, okay? And if enlightening you is going to change the world, then you need to get your ass on and get out there and change the world. But that's not what's going on here. E.T. has not done either one. They have not enlightened everybody, and they have not wiped us out. E.T. could pop up tomorrow morning, hover over the North and South Pole, and just tell the world, look, one world government, everybody gets together, everybody lives in harmony, or nobody, and then wipe out a continent. And, you know, hell, we'd all be united after that. But they're not doing that. They're working behind the scenes, under the scenes, with contactees. And they want the contactees out there talking about their experiences with other contactees, finding contactees, educating the contactees and abductees. They don't care if the regular population knows. If they wanted CNN to know, they would go land on CNN's front, on CNN's roof, and let them videotape them all day, but they're not. So they don't really care if CNN knows. They don't really care if Fox knows. They don't really care if Obama knows. All they care about is the contactees, their project, their promos, their world, not ours. And don't ever mistake this. This is not about us. This is about them. For all the contactees out there that are always writing to me and telling me this is all about us, you are wrong. This is about them. actions speak louder than words, and the actions suggest that this is about them and not about us. Like I said before, they haven't wiped us out, and they haven't enlightened us. They haven't given us longer lifespans or really advanced technologies or any of this stuff. Okay? The only percentage of the population that's even shown any kind of enlightened abilities are contactees. And they seem to be very empathic and telepathic. Some of them even seem to be a little bit clairvoyant. But none of the rest of the population is showing that. And if you don't believe me, this is an easy thing to do. Find 10 contactees, get some cards and some letters, and get 2 friends, okay? Do some colors and some numbers, show them to your friend, put them down, have the contactees select them. You'll find that a lot of people, a lot of contactees will be between 60 and 85% correct. Now, you go to your average mall and pick out 10 people that you know or you think are not contactees and have them do it. They won't even get 50-50. They'll usually get like 48-52 against them. Now, the law of averages say that anybody picking randomly is 50-50 chance, but you won't even see that. There doesn't even seem to be any clairvoyance or any empathic abilities there at all. And if they are, they're very slim. And I think anybody that does have them probably has the DNA that the contact, the abductees, or I should say the aliens are looking for. I don't think it's accidental. Either they created it 10 or 20,000 years ago, or they recognized it in specific families that long ago and has been cultivating it ever since. I really don't know which one it is, but I do know it's part of what they're doing. Just like we know that part of the breeding program is part of what they're doing. You know, these things we know, it's just, you know, exactly what they're going to do with it, we don't know. We're guessing.
Very, very intriguing there, Joe. Now, Joe, with the ability of the experiencers, do you, and contactees, synonymous terms actually, do you think that experiencers, well, actually not. Experiencers can be both abductees and contactees. But now, Joe, with experiencers, do you think that in the future they may be viewed as a resource for information from the military and the government, or the government? Also, in the future, could experiencers be a victim of discrimination or exploitation?
Well, I have to say yes and all. We already know now that the government is interested in contactees and abductees. Well, not so much abductees, but contactees they seem to be really, really interested in. And they seem to be more interested in the famous ones than the non-famous ones, but they do seem to be interested in non-famous ones. The contactees that tend to speak out or come out tend to get NOAA'd. I know I shouldn't say that on air because that makes a lot of people not want to do it, but organizations like ours can help you with that. And we get a lot of credit for NOAA'd stopping when contactees come to our organization. Let me explain this, ladies and gentlemen. It's nothing that I or anyone's personally doing. The fact that the organization does so many interviews with so many people and makes it public, there's no real need to do the NOAA. Let me put it another way. Let's say I got Melinda Leslie on the show, and she was talking about some kind of alien technology. They can just call into the show and ask the question. I will ask the question for them. There's no need for them to take them away and do all this when they just call Joe, ask her if the control rod inserted this way would do this. They can ask that. Now, granted, our contactees still get NOAA'd, but they do seem to get NOAA'd less. So take it for what it is. I get a lot of people writing to me about how it stopped, and as much as I would love to take credit for it, I can't. All I can say is what I just said about it, and, you know, we'll have to go from there on it. I do think it, and as far as discrimination goes, go to work tomorrow and tell your boss you're an abductee and getting probed by aliens and see if you still got a job the next day. Even now we're being discriminated against. I do think all of this will taper off over time. But it's like everything else. There's always going to be some, you know, just like with racism, there's always going to be some people that will not change. They're just going to be that way. But I do think overall it is getting better. I know I lost a job a long time ago because of a comment I made about aliens. And we won't get into it, but I lost a job over it. And they even told me why they let me go. I should have sued them, but I didn't, because they really hooked me up afterwards. But still, they let me go just because of that. Now, 20 years later, if I went there and did it again, I probably wouldn't lose my job, because they would probably understand it better today, because there is more education on the subject matter. But still, people are loopy about it, freaky about it. A lot of people are not going to understand this. and they may understand you having an interest in it or chasing UFOs, but when you start saying aliens are coming and taking you, oh no. You've pretty much just isolated yourself. That's why ICAR exists, for those people. That's what we're here for, to protect and help those people. That's what we do. I mean, any way we can or anyhow we can, even if it's, you know, picking in or mass writing in or just therapy or support groups. I mean, it's why we're here. And gathering information is second nature for us. It's to help. The more we know, the more we understand, the easier it is to help somebody. I get people all the time that write to me in a platitude of experiences that I know are not true. Now, this is a tough thing when you're talking to an abductee, including myself. When you tell an abductee that they ain't experiencing what they are, they get pissed, which I can't blame them, because then you're questioning who they are. And but what they don't understand, and after I talk to them for a while, they do, but this is the deal. Okay, we know there are fundamental basic things that happen in abductions. That's why we have abduction criteria. But then there's all this stuff that every contactee talks about, but only they talk about it. Now, ICAR alone probably has more than 10,000 people that have contacted us about this over the years. And the thing about it is they can't all be right. And if all 10,000 and each one is different on the end, then who's right and who's not? So the problem here is making the contactee understand, well, first, ET lies. Secondly, you exaggerate. Sometimes it's exaggeration or lie, and your mind trying to deal with it all at the same time, but it's not the truth. It's not what really happened. Or sometimes it's just easier to think, well, it's all fluffy white, and they love me and hug me and kiss me and pat my little butt with baby powder. It just, you know, it's a safer way of looking at things. You know, I don't want to think aliens come take people and do hostile stuff or take people's kids or things like that. You know, I just asked a good contact the other day. I said, well, you don't mind them taking your son and your daughter without asking you first? And she got pissed. She's like, you know, I never thought of it like that, Joe, but you're right, they do. I'm like, yeah, they do. And she said, well, I had a good experience. I said, but did they ask mom or dad, could they take your kids? I said, let me put it another way. Let's say you're standing out on the side of the street and some guy all dressed up pretty and fancy walks and said, let me take your two kids for a ride for a couple of hours and do some experiments and bring them back. I said, what the hell are you going to tell them? I said, you're going to lose your mind, probably shoot them. And see, contactees don't stop and think about things like that. You know, they get caught up in the moment, and they're not really thinking of what's really going on, what really just happened, the fact that they just took your children on a spaceship and did things to them, sometimes with you, sometimes not with you. And then contactees tend to get a different attitude. Go ahead.
Pardon me. You know, just from my heart, I always have to commend you on this consistent viewpoint. You've held it across the years that abduction by ET of humans represents a violation. You've always remained true to that opinion, and I agree. I think the abduction intrusion is violative of human rights and core legal norms, and I commend you on that. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No. It's a good thing. And no, I agree. I mean, I think it's unfortunate there wasn't something legal we could do about it. I'd shoot a pants off them little graves if they had any pants. It's just, and you have to be, because people have to understand, if E.T. did not call you up on the phone and say, Jane Smith, I want to come take you for a ride in my pretty blue spaceship and show you and enlighten your mind, you've just been abducted. And then it's really hard to get across to people that E.T. lies. And then there's been a new movement lately. I call it the Billy Meyer movement, which probably I shouldn't do. But there have been a bunch of contactees, not a bunch, probably a dozen or so in the last year, that have written to me and told me only their experiences are correct. No one else's experiences are correct. Okay, well, you know, that's Billy Meyer in a nutshell. He thinks his experiences are the only ones correct, which about 80% of what he says is absolute garbage. He is a contactee, though. I do believe Billy Myers is a contactee from the best I can tell. I do think it, and I do think some of his photos are legit. I just think a lot of them are fake, and I think he BS's a lot. But by saying that, we do have this new movement that is, I am the only one that's correct. Well, first off, we know abductions happen in mass. We've seen mass abductions ourselves, so we know there's not just one contactee with one answer. We already know that. And for the ones that do that, I really think they should seek professional help. Guys, I retain a lot of my abduction experiences, a lot. I have very good friends that obtain a lot of their abduction experiences, and I talk to contactees every day for the last 20 years, and I still couldn't make permanent answers like that. I'm like, there's no way. You can't. I mean, there's just too much unknown here and too many things that we just either can't understand because we're simply not enlightened enough to understand it, or simply because E.T. doesn't want us to understand it. Sometimes I think they like keeping us as their little dumb children or cousins or chihuahuas or something, whatever they think of us. Because that varies from person to person on what they think about it. But they have been here a long time. Okay.
Now, Joe, Icar, you and Icar really furnished a tremendous amount of extremely essential and helpful information to experiencers. Now, Joe, your lovely wife, Linda, is a certified hypnotherapist. She has helped many understand their experiences. Could you tell the audience the benefits of this type of regression? Also, there are some people who might not wish to delve into hypnotherapy if they're not ready for this step, but those who are ready for this type of regression can benefit from it, truly benefit from it. Your comments, please.
Well, you know, she is stricter on regression than I am. She does get in, you know, she will regress you if she thinks you need it, and if she can help you with it, she will, and she's damn good at it. She just did. Matt just recently, the New Orleans police officer that's having the reptilian experiences, eventually that'll be made available if I can ever get my lazy butt to upload it to the internet for the ICAR directors. I'm sorry, it'll be available for everybody, but it will be available for them. Actually, ICAR directors, I'm going to put it up on You Send It Saturday. If y'all want to send me an email, I'll send it over to y'all. And y'all can take a look at it and tell me what you think about that, and then if you want to write to Matt, you can. But to make a long story short, ICAR itself is very, very, very strict on regression. We do not believe in using regression unless there is no other way, or if we've heard something over and over and over and we want to verify it through hypnosis, we'll do that. You know, you'll see when Linda's doing the regression, the last one, there's no leading questions asked. It's not how you do it. You really want the person the first time to tell you about the experience. You don't want to tell them. You don't even want to interfere. You want them to tell you about the experience and then you can kind of go through and say, okay, after they've given your whole experience to you, then you can go through and carefully pick out questions that need to be asked, but without using words like, well, what kind of alien spacecraft was that? Or what kind of alien was that coming? No, you can't say that kind of stuff. You know, and she's really good at it. She wouldn't remember, she really didn't want to do it, but she is really good at it. And she's a natural, really.
Yes.
So it's nice to see that, but as an organization, we don't want to use it as, okay, let me say it like this. For a lot of people, regression is the first tool, okay? And for them, it's the all-telling, all-knowing tool. For me, that is bad, 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 bad business. I would rather sit down and question a contactee, work through them, use some different type of relaxation technique, put them in touch with other contactees, get them inside the support group, and let them start experiencing and sharing at the same time. I find that opens up contactees much faster, much better, and gives much more reliable information than regressions or other forms of doing this stuff. But we do use regression. I mean, it will be used. It's one of those things, if it needs to be used, it will be used. And it will be used strictly and sparingly, and it's the way it should be used in every organization. Now, you know, I noticed some researchers out there that are friends of mine that use it a lot, but they're really good at it. Some of them I don't know because I haven't sat and watched the tapes myself, but it does have a place and it does have a usefulness in organization. Oh, I'm going to be on. The show I'm doing tomorrow from 1 to 3 is Hidden Experiences with, what's his last name? Mike Cleveland? Cleveland? Mike, I hope I didn't butcher your name. And as soon as it's available, I'll let everybody know and y'all can check it out. It's a kind of a semi, well, anyway, I'll let y'all check it out when it's available. But it is something the organizations, you know, should really think hard about using hypnosis, using things like that. So the person just asked me, why should we voice dress somebody or polygraph them? I'm not a big fan of polygraphing, I'll tell you why. On at least 4 occasions in my life, I passed polygraph when I knew I was lying, okay? So I'm not a big fan of polygraphs. Voice dress, on the other hand, is admissible in courts of law in several places in the United States. And it, along with facial software, or just a good eye if you've had the right courses, and I've had the courses and I got the software, you can really, really tell someone's lying or telling the truth. Now, it's not a prerequisite, and we want you to take a voice stress test with the organization. We don't. And we're not, probably won't even ask you to do so. If you volunteer to do it, then we will do it, and we will give you the results. Now, if you're making claims that can only be verified by that, then we might ask you. The thing about it is it's not an all-telling, all-knowing tool. It is a tool. Just like regression, just like therapy, it's a tool. And that's what we use it as. To put this in perspective, I'm not going to say who this was, but a couple of months back, they were showing the different guys talking about their experiences at the nuclear silos. I know y'all are familiar with all of that. I voice stressed 6 of them. 3 of them passed, 3 of them failed. And 3 of them failed miserably. I mean, any way you looked at it, they had to have been lying because they failed so miserably that there was no explanation other than they were lying. And I showed the results to several other investigators, and they agreed there was no other way than the fact that they were lying. So 3 of those witnesses tested perfectly, and they were saying exactly what they saw and exactly what they experienced, which means that should be used in tandem with them to help, you know, put their experiences out to the world. The other 3 shouldn't even be allowed to speak anymore unless they can explain why they failed so miserably. But that's not my job. I just was bored that day and was listening, so I did it. and voice stress is much different. It's not like polygraph. You don't have to keyword it out and things. It's simple. You can just pick up the tones of the voice, run them through the things, and find out. They say, oh, you got to establish a lie and a truth. Actually, it's not quite like that. It's a little bit different than that. When a person's talking and they're going through, like, polygraph checks, you know, your heart rate and things like this, this is much different. People, when they're normally talking, have a specific way they're going to talk. When you're not lying and you're just chit-chatting with your friends, it doesn't matter who you are, by the way. Everybody does this on the planet. Then with a person, you speak in this particular way. And if you're comfortable with somebody, you speak this way much more fluently. So these are things we pick up on right quickly. All right? If someone's lying, their voice actually stresses. It actually stresses. It cracks, it peaks, it moves. There are specific things you're looking for in a test that suggest that someone's lying. Now, the reason you want to use the facial software with this is because that keys off. In other words, let's say that you're stressing and you pick up a tone or a cracked voice, okay, and you see that person's face physically change. Now, you can know at that moment, was he clearing his throat? Was there a bug? Was he choking? Or was he lying? Did his eyes bunch up? Did his beard? Did his face cheeks change? Was he lying? This is a real good combination of software to use to tell someone's lying or telling the truth. And it works really, really well. And several countries around the world use it besides the United States. It's advanced software. It's advanced technology, and it works well. And, you know, like I said, I'm not going to put every contactee to it because I don't feel the need to stress out every contactee. But the ones that want the extra authenticity to their accounts, it is available for them. And occasionally I just like to voice stress people because I get bored. I will occasionally from time to time voice stress other guests on other shows. I have never voice stressed anybody without their permission on any of our shows or any in the organizations, but radio is public domain. So yeah, if you're talking on a radio, you can be voice stressed. Just so y'all know that in case y'all, you know, I know a lot of people get a misconception about how this works.
Very true. That sounds like very interesting new investigative techniques. Definite new resources there for confirmation. A couple of questions here, Joe. You have mentioned that, am I correct here? You've mentioned that the human race, is that an accurate comment?
Wait. Say that again, because I heard hybrid race, but I didn't hear what you said before that.
Would you describe the human race as a hybrid race?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Any way you look at us, I can't see how we're not a hybrid race. Let's say, okay, we say, well, we naturally evolved. Okay, well, we naturally evolved, and then the humans mess with us. Well, we're hybrid. Oh, well, then the reptilians are. Oh, well, then we're hybrid. And the greys, we're hybrid. Oh, well, the 3 of them put together made us. Either way, we're a hybrid race. There's no way of escaping the fact that this race is a hybrid race, that it was probably not natively developed on this planet. Either we were brought here, or the aliens came here and created us. And now, was there actually a starting race here? Maybe. Maybe there was a ape-like species here that the aliens that the Sumerians talk about took and molded into the seven creations of man, and then the reptilians interbred with them and created the species that's here today with the gray influence somewhere along the line. That's all possible. I mean, the problem here is the creation story is in every culture, okay? Mm. It's in most religions. So here we go. We've got the Sumerians talking about this great human-like race that created a race like themselves, and in turn, that race created the seven creations of man, with the seventh creation being man-like, but not quite what we are today. But that's the one that the reptilians used to go in and rape their women, and their women were born, the children were born, and the children were different, but they weren't different in the fact that they looked different, they acted different, they had become self-aware. They were asking questions like, why the hell do I have to plot a field? Why don't you go plot a field? Why am I doing this? Who are you? Why are we here? Things that they never asked before, because all the stories currently before that, including like in the Christian Bibles and all say the same things. The species here was subservient. They could do things like name the animals, plow, procreate. But they didn't ask why they had to plot a field. They didn't ask why were they living here. They didn't ask, you know, what made the sky go? Why did the sun rise? And so they didn't ask any of that. Because they really weren't a sentient species like we are today. But when they say when the reptilians interbred with them, that all changed. They became a sentient species. The best known story is the story of Adam and Eve. When Eve, the serpent brings Eve the apple, she bites it. What's the first thing Eve does? The very first thing Eve does is she puts clothes on. Well, she puts the fig, but still. She dresses herself. And why does she dress herself? Because she now realizes she is naked to the world. She is now self-aware. Before that, she was walking around in a fantasy land and had no clue of what was going on. All of a sudden, she is self-aware. What's so important about this story is it's not so much that it proves the existence of man or God. It proves the fact that there was reptilian intervention in our society, along with the reptilian suction in our brain, really proves it. So here you've got the Sumerians, the Egyptians, the Dogon, the Aborigines, all the Mesoamericans, even the Native Americans, having these stories. So the problem is it started long before the Adam and Eve story, and it's been going on much after it. And then there's another little thing. In all the ancient cultures, the reptilians were revered, even in the Mesoamerican culture. But right around the time of Christ, for some reason, that changed. They went from being revered to feared. Why is that? And I've asked quite a few archaeologists about this, and I've asked quite a few people in general about this. What changed? What, per se, changed on the planet? Was some kind of interbreeding that made us have an unnatural fear for reptilians? How did they get portrayed as the bad guy? Well, they got portrayed as the bad guy because modern religion came along, and of course reptilians are evil, even though they're not. That's just how modern religion portrayed them. And that's where we got to where we are today. But you've got to wonder. I mean, even in the Mesoamerican tribes, you'll see them. They're carrying the serpents. They're the bringers of life, the bringers of change. They always feared the human gods. So did the Egyptians, so did the Sumerians. So all these people today tell you the humans are all nice and sweet, but all the ancients say, oh, no, they weren't. Today they tell you the reptilians are bad, but the ancients always said they were good. The ancients said they were Anguarians. They weren't even And they weren't even reptilians, they were amphibians. They lived in the water and breathed in the water. So you got to wonder why this changed so dramatically in 2,000 years. Who got involved? Well, man got involved. That's who got involved. Before that, we were a minor player in the thing. Now we are a major player. It's a strange thing, but it's just stuff for people to think about. You know, it's all there. All the history is there. I mean, everybody can read it for yourself. The Sumerian text has been retranslated now for the third time. It's actually quite a bit better than the first time when Stitchin read it. So it actually, like Nerebru, they no longer translate Nerebru as a planet, but as a moon. Something about the size of the moon. It actually says that at one time, at two different points in the Sumerians' existence, there was two moons in the sky. And then it would go. They even talked about flooding and stuff like that as well. These weren't planets. It was probably some kind of spaceship because it would leave and come, and it would pull into orbit. Okay, rogue planets, guys, like everybody says, planet the Reaver is coming to get us, we'll have to load, but it wouldn't pull in orbit. Okay, only a spacecraft is going to pull in orbit. our planet's not really big enough to be capturing big rocks, so only spaceships are going to pull in orbit. So those kind of things you can find in the text, and it helps us to understand, you know, why some of this stuff was missed. You'd like to somebody say it comes every 3,600 years. That's probably true. They probably used to come every 30, and probably still do, just now they come cloaked. They probably come around and visit every so often and check, or maybe they just stay here all the time, and that's when the mothership comes around. Who knows for sure? But still, you know, it probably still works that way. It's just it wasn't a planet, it was a ship. And it never made sense to me. I couldn't believe Stitching. I couldn't, and Ike and all them were this dumb. You know, simple physics tells you a planet five times the size of the Earth passing anywhere near us is utter, total, complete disaster. No survivors, Earth life ending completely on our planet. Just, it's not going to happen, guys. There is nothing that can pass through the solar system without wiping us out that big. It's just not going to happen. Since we're all still here, we can pretty much rule out that that's what actually went on. Okay? We can kind of rule out that some giant planet didn't come parking itself next to us and floating through our galaxy, our solar system. That it just didn't. And there's other things besides that. This is another thing that gets me about humans. There's history. Nowhere in recorded history, not, and the Chinese and the Egyptians were best for this, and the Mesoamericans, none of them recorded in the rebirth. There's 6,000 years of astronomy in China. None of them recorded it. There's 5,000 in Egypt. No one recorded it. There's 3,400 in Mesoamerica. No one's recorded it. So you got to kind of wonder, well, if it comes around Earth, apparently we missed it last time. But more importantly than that, there's no gaps in the Oort cloud. There's no gaps in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. Do you realize something five times the size of Earth, how many asteroids and crap it's going to sweep along with it as it comes through our solar system? Whether it's coming up, down, or across. It doesn't matter how it's approaching the ellipse, it's still five times the size of Earth, and it's going to drag everything around it with it. And passing near any other planets, it's going to make complete and utter chaos. There's none of that going on. I don't see Mars contracting and shrinking or Venus shaking or even us for that matter. So some things you can rule out. Are there other planets out there? Yeah, there's other planets. Are there rogue planets? Yeah, there's rogue planets. Is Nibiru coming to kill us? No, it's not. Get over it. Get a life. Or stop smoking that stuff, one or the other. I'll be good there.
Well, you know, this field does have really interesting discussion points. And, you know, Joe, there's even a discussion of ET delving into the field of soul transfer. Joe, what aspects of humans do ETs find most intriguing? What do you think? What will be your opinion on that?
You know, there's brunettes with them pretty big blue eyes. No, I'm just kidding. They, you know, it's interesting you said about the soul thing because this was something we had found that it's still weird to me out today. ET has the ability, at least the grays, I can't speak for them, but at least the grays have the ability to download a consciousness from one body to the next. Now, I imagine this started out with them. They don't use cloning. People always thought grays were clones. They're not clones. They simply will make a new body, grow a new body from their own source, not from clone DNA or anything like that, and just download their consciousness into a new body. Now, they live a very long time to start off with. You know, some people say hundreds of thousands, some people say millions. No one really knows. But they live a really long time because the way we know that is occasionally we'll get like a great-great-great-great-grandmother who will make a footnote in a notebook about a particular visitation and how it acted and how it acted towards her. And here you are like 200 years later and you're listening to the great-granddaughter and she's talking about the same damn alien. And the alien itself even portrays or lays over to them that, yes, I am the one who abducted your great-great-great-grandmother. And if you want to know the truth, I'm the one who abducted your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother. So we know they live a long time, and we know they work in the same family lines. Those things we know for sure. So that's interesting for me. If anything, I don't know. You know, some people say it might be their own family lines. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, they have the ability to download these bodies. Well, We get these reports, and these are weird reports. Just got one just about 4 days ago, too. It's strange. I'll get a report. They'll be on board a ship or in some facility somewhere, and there'll be just rows and rows and rows and rows of tubes. And in these tubes will be people. Sometimes there'll be like families in a line or something. As a matter of fact, the lady the other day was telling me it was her and her three kids and her grandmother. But there'll be people missing sometimes, like a husband might miss it. But anyway, there'll be these things. And I'm like, and she said, well, Joe, I looked at it, it was me. And she said, I didn't understand, but she said, you know, it was me, but it looked a little bit different than me. I mean, it was me, I could tell it was me, but the body was structured a little bit different, the head might have been a little bit different, but it was me. And I'm like, well, did you feel, was it alive? She said, well, I don't know if it was alive, but it was definitely a copy of me of some kind. And over the years, we've had to contact these apps. That is so they can download your consciousness into that host body. Now, at the time, we didn't realize it. This is some research that came in the last few years. You know, we never realized, like, in the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of UFO sightings over hospitals and mortuaries. And not mortuaries, but, you know, what do you bring by? Morgues, I'm sorry. Yeah, mortuary, morgue. Mm-hmm. But anyway, not so much the mortuaries, but the morgues and the hospitals, there was a lot of UFO reports. And I was like, what in the hell are they doing? Well, now I know what they're doing. They're taking the damn consciousness. Probably at the moment of death or however long it lasts afterwards, but they're taking it and they're putting it in a new body. Now, this in itself is weird. What the hell could they be doing this for? And what are they doing with these people? And should we really be worried about this? I don't know, guys. You know, there's a lot of speculation here, but there's a lot of evidence that also goes along with it, you know, from different contactees. I mean, probably to date, 400 or 500 contactees have said this. And they say it pretty much identically every time. And when they ask the aliens what it is, that's what the aliens tell them. This is so that we can put you in the off-world colony, but we don't want to take you while you're here on Earth, but we'll take you after you pass, and we'll put you into this, and you'll go spend whatever time or live whatever time there, however long those bodies last. I have no idea. But they say this all the time, and it really freaks me out. They also say about taking a percentage of this population, but also leaving a percentage of this population. And you never hear any contactees talk about normal people. There seems, matter of fact, and this is another weird thing, in the last 5 years we've noticed this extremely bad. Contactees are pushing themselves away from everyday people. They're disconnecting themselves. In other words, they'll go to work, they'll associate, they'll have drinks and stuff like that, but the way they feel about them is different. In other words, most of us have apathy when we see someone hurt or someone dying or something. We feel sad or whatever, but we feel apathy towards the individual. Contactees are starting to push themselves further away, so like if they do have to feel it, it's not going to be as intense. Even though they seem to be growing themselves closer and stronger to other contactees and other family members, everyday people, they seem to be pushing themselves like they're expecting something to happen. These kind of things really worry me because I don't know what they mean. You know, we've got the Holocaust students, and now we've got contactees disassociating themselves with the everyday population. Not to where they're pointed, they're considered unsociable or weird, but to their own self inside. Outwardly, they're probably still acting like they always are, but I'm literally, every contactee I've talked to in the last 2 years has pretty much said the same thing. I don't feel the same about everybody else as I feel about other contactees. And I'll ask them questions like, well, if they all got wiped out, would you be disappointed? Well, I might be a little sad, but no big deal. Now, prior to this, most contactees were very protective over the rest of the population. So these kind of things really freaked me out. We'll see where it all goes. I mean, we got lots of projects running. I got a couple other new projects in the works that I want to get going. Like I was telling you, we want to get the part two of that Now project going with...
Yes, personality traits.
And what we'll do is we'll just go on there and change the title and put on there, please contactees only, and abductees only, and we'll have that started resubmitting. Or we'll just make a new section. I mean, it's lots of space over there. So, ladies and gentlemen, I know we're getting short on time. A couple of quick things. Looking for volunteers. We're getting ready to remodel four websites. Four websites, guys. Any ideas, any volunteers, okay? Write to me, uprn@cox.net. We're getting ready to put up new banners, change dropout layouts, colors. We may go from black to white pages. We may go to green. I don't know. But anyway, all of these sites are getting a rebuild. Even the old Alien Enigma site, which is ancient now, is going to get a uplift and a facelift. Also, we want to make the sites a little bit more functional and a little bit more appealing to everybody. So any ideas about that? Also, recently, to all the young college kids that have joined the organization or have joined the Facebook pages, welcome, guys. It is pleasant to see this group. We recently had a group of about 22 to about 27 join in mass. So I have really been pleasantly surprised to see that. And then we've got another group out of college, 28 to 35. Actually, we've incorporated about 100 new members in that area, which is very nice to see. It's very nice to see. I know other organizations are having a hard time attracting younger people and more professional people, but it looks like ours are getting a little bit easier, which is kind of nice to see. Y'all don't be counting me down. I own a damn radio station. I'll stay on the midnight if I want to. I mean, come on now. Kevin Smith ain't come on tonight. He's over with.
Indeed. And I'm not one of those culpable parties. Joe, what an informative and dynamic discussion. I look forward very, very much to witnessing all the exciting new developments that ICAR is continuing to present to the field. I hope you'll be a return guest in the very near future. Thank you again for the privilege of being on your network and also for being a member of ICAR.
Oh, well, in truth, I love coming on your show. You're always a great, it's always an easy interview. I always enjoy it, and you know you're always welcome with us. So, besides, we're getting ready to put Trees back to work anyway. I got some new ideas in my brain. We've developed more research in the last three years than ICAR did in its first six. I'm amazed myself when I look at this stuff. I'm sitting here going, wow, did we do that? Wow. Anyway, guys, I had a great time, Trees. It was fantastic night. So we had a nice big audience, well over 100,000. So everybody tuning in out there, I hope y'all enjoyed it, guys. We don't have nobody following us. Next week, though, we do have a new show. I think it's next week. I'll double-check that. We're going to have a new show following Trees next week. I have the information finally, shame on me, but I will bring it up Wednesday night on my show. And I will discuss it. And by the way, I'll be being interviewed Wednesday by Jason, I believe. And then Therese and I will be, well, actually, Therese and about a month and a half will be guest hosting for us on a panel discussion. Y'all got to be sure to catch that because I'm going to be on the panel, so I can't host. So anyway, that's all stuff y'all got to look forward to. Also, like I said, anything about the sites, any ideas about designs, functionalities, things like that, feel free to write to me, UPN or Cox.net. Everybody else, you want to write to me at icarcox.net, feel free. Any questions, ideas, designs, comments, complaints, moans, groans, or bitches, write to me anytime. Any other time.
Excellent, Joe. Well, again, thank you for this very informative and dynamic discussion.
Thank you, Trees.
And great weekend, everyone. Thank you for listening to A Global Focus tonight with our guest, Joe Montaldo, the International Director of ICAR, the International Community for Alien Research, and owner of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. We appreciate your time with us and look forward to your joining the discussion each week on A Global Focus. Good night and great weekend.